Pours forces through the gap like a stream bursting a dam at its weakest point. Wolf smiled to himself. He felt he was playing a major role in the struggle for German domination of North Africa. He found it enormously satisfying. In the bedroom, a cork popped. Smith always surprised Wolf by the rapidity of his lovemaking. The cork popping was the sign that it was all over, and Wolf had a few minutes in which to tidy up before Smith came in search of his shorts. He put the papers back in the case, locked it, and put the key back in the shorts' pocket. He no longer got back into the cupboard afterward. Once had been enough. He put his shoes in his trousers' pockets and tiptoed soundlessly in his socks up the ladder, across the deck, and down the gangplank to the towpath. Then he put his shoes on and went to lunch. Kemmel shook hands politely and said, "I hope your injury is healing rapidly, Major."
"Sit down," Van Damme said. "The bandage is more damn nuisance than the wound. What have you got?"
Kemmel sat down and crossed his legs, adjusting the crease of his black cotton trousers.
"I thought I would bring the surveillance report myself, although I'm afraid there's nothing of interest in it."
Van Damme took the envelope and opened it. It contained a single typewritten sheet. He began to read. Sonia had come home, presumably from the Cha-Cha Club, at 11 o'clock the previous night. She had been alone. She had surfaced at around 10 the following morning and had been seen on deck in a robe. The postman had come at 1. Sonia had gone out at 4 and returned at 6 carrying a bag bearing the name of one of the more expensive dress shops in Cairo. At that hour, the watcher had been relieved by the nightman. Yesterday, Van Damme had received by messenger a similar report from Kemmel covering the first 12 hours of the surveillance. For 2 days, therefore, Sonia's behavior had been routine and wholly innocent, and neither Wolf nor anyone else had visited her on the houseboat. Van Damme was bitterly disappointed. Kemmel said, "The men I am using are completely reliable, and they are reporting directly to me." Van Damme grunted, then roused himself to be courteous. "Yes, I'm sure," he said. "Thank you for coming in." Kemmel stood up.
"No trouble," he said. "Goodbye."
He went out. Van Damme sat brooding. He had read Kemmel's report again, as if there might have been clues between the lines. If Sonia was connected with Wolf, and Van Damme still believed she was somehow, clearly the association was not a close one. If she was meeting anyone, the meetings must be taking place away from the houseboat. Van Damme went to the door and called,
"Jakes!" "Sir!"
Van Damme sat down again and Jakes came in. Van Damme said, "From now on, I want you to spend your evenings at the Cha-Cha Club. Watch Sonia and observe whom she sits with after the show. Also, bribe a waiter to tell you whether anyone goes to her dressing room."
"Very good, sir."
Van Damme nodded dismissal and added with a smile, "Permission to enjoy yourself is granted." The smile was a mistake. It hurt. At least he was no longer trying to live on glucose dissolved in warm water. Gafar was giving him mashed potatoes and gravy, which he could eat from a spoon and swallow without chewing. He was existing on that and gin. Dr. Abathnot had also told him he drank too much and smoked too much, and he had promised to cut down after the war. Privately, he thought, "After I've caught Wolf." If Sonia was not going to lead him to Wolf, only Elena could. Van Damme was ashamed of his outburst at Elena's apartment. He had been angry at his own failure, and the thought of her with Wolf had maddened him. His behavior could be described only as a fit of bad temper. Elena was a lovely girl who was risking her neck to help him, and courtesy was the least he owed her. Wolf had said he would see Elena again. Van Damme hoped he would contact her soon. He still felt irrationally angry at the thought of the two of them together. But now that the houseboat angle had turned out to be a dead end, Elena was his only hope. He sat at his desk, waiting for the phone to ring, dreading the very thing he wanted most. Elena went shopping in the late afternoon.
Her apartment had come to seem claustrophobic after she had spent most of the day pacing around, unable to concentrate on anything, alternately miserable and happy. So she put on a cheerful striped dress and went out into the sunshine. She liked the fruit and vegetable market. It was a lively place, especially at this end of the day when the tradesmen were trying to get rid of the last of their produce. She stopped to buy tomatoes. The man who served her picked up one with a slight bruise and threw it away dramatically before filling a paper bag with undamaged specimens. Elena laughed, for she knew that the bruised tomato would be retrieved as soon as she was out of sight and put back on the display so that the whole pantomime could be performed again for the next customer. She haggled briefly over the price, but the vendor could tell that her heart was not in it, and she ended up paying almost what he had asked originally. She bought eggs, too, having decided to make an omelet for supper. It was good to be carrying a basket of food, more food than she could eat at one meal. It made her feel safe. She could remember days when there had been no supper. She left the market and went window shopping for dresses. She bought most of her clothes on impulse. She had firm ideas about what she liked, and if she planned a trip to buy something special, she could never find it. She wanted one day to have her own dressmaker. She thought, I wonder if William Van Damme could afford that for his wife. When she thought of Van Damme, she was happy. Until she thought of Wolf. She knew she could escape, if she wished, simply by refusing to see Wolf, refusing to make a date with him, refusing to answer his message. She was under no obligation to act as the bait in a trap for a knife murderer. She kept returning to this idea, worrying at it like a loose tooth. I don't have to. She suddenly lost interest in dresses and headed for home. She wished she could make an omelet for two, but omelet for one was something to be thankful for. There was a certain unforgettable pain in the stomach which came when, having gone to bed with no supper, you woke up in the morning to no breakfast. The 10-year-old Elena had wondered, secretly, how long people took to starve to death. She was sure Van Damme's childhood had not suffered such worries. When she turned into the entrance to her apartment block, a voice said, Abigail! She froze with shock. It was the voice of a ghost. She did not dare to look. The voice came again. Abigail! She made herself turn around. A figure came out of the shadows. An old Jew, shabbily dressed, with a matted beard, veined feet in rubber tire sandals. Elena said, Father. He stood in front of her, as if afraid to touch her, just looking. He said, So beautiful still, and not poor. Impulsively, she stepped forward, kissed his cheek, then stepped back again. She did not know what to say. He said, Your grandfather, my father, has died. She took his arm and led him up the stairs. It was all unreal, irrational, like a dream. Inside the apartment, she said, You should eat, and took him into the kitchen. She put a pan on to heat and began to beat the eggs. With her back to her father, she said, How did you find me?
I've always known where you were, he said. Your friend Esma writes to her father, who sometimes I see.
Esma was an acquaintance rather than a friend, but Elena ran into her every 2 or 3 months. She had never let on that she was writing home. Elena said, I didn't want you to ask me to come back.
And what would I have said to you? Come home, it is your duty to starve with your family? No. But I knew where you were.
She sliced tomatoes into the omelet. You would have said it was better to starve than to live immorally.
Yes, I would have said that. And would I have been wrong?
She turned to look at him. The glaucoma, which had taken the sight of his left eye years ago, was now spreading to the right. He was 55, she calculated. He looked 70. Yes, you would have been wrong, she said. It is always better to live.
Perhaps it is.
Her surprise must have shown on her face, for he explained,
I'm not as certain of these things as I used to be. I'm getting old.
Elena halved the omelet and slid it onto two plates. She put bread on the table. Her father washed his hands, then blessed the bread.
Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe.
Elena was surprised that the prayer did not drive her into a fury. In the blackest moments of her lonely life, she had cursed and raged at her father and his religion for what it had driven her to. She had tried to cultivate an attitude of indifference, perhaps mild contempt, but she had not quite succeeded. Now, watching him pray, she thought, "And what do I do when this man whom I hate turns up on the doorstep? I kiss his cheek, and I bring him inside, and I give him supper." They began to eat. Her father had been very hungry and wolfed his food. Elena wondered why he had come. Was it just to tell her of the death of her grandfather? No. That was part of it, perhaps, but there would be more. She asked about her sisters. After the death of her mother, all four of them, in their different ways, had broken with their father. Two had gone to America. One had married the son of her father's greatest enemy, and the youngest, Naomi, had chosen the surest escape and died. It dawned on Elena that her father was destroyed. He asked her what she was doing. She decided to tell him the truth. "The British are trying to catch a man, a German. They think he's a spy. It's my job to befriend him. I'm the bait in a snare, but I think I may not help them anymore." He had stopped eating.
"Are you afraid?"
She nodded. "He's very dangerous. He killed a soldier with a knife. Last night, I was to meet him in a restaurant, and the British were to arrest him there. But something went wrong, and I spent the whole evening with him. I was so frightened, and when it was over, the Englishman..." She stopped and took a deep breath. "Anyway, I may not help them anymore." Her father went on eating.
"Do you love this Englishman?"
"He isn't Jewish," she said defiantly.
"I've given up judging everyone," he said.
Elena could not take it all in. Was there nothing of the old man left? They finished their meal, and Elena got up to make him a glass of tea. He said,
"The Germans are coming. It will be very bad for Jews. I'm getting out."
She frowned. "Where will you go?"
"Jerusalem."
"How will you get there? The trains are full. There's a quota for Jews."
"I am going to walk."
She stared at him, not believing he could be serious, not believing he would joke about such a thing.
"Walk?"
He smiled.
"It's been done before."
She saw that he meant it, and she was angry with him. "As I recall, Moses never made it."
"Perhaps I will be able to hitch a ride."
"It's crazy."
"Haven't I always been a little crazy?"
"Yes," she shouted. Suddenly her anger collapsed. "Yes, you've always been a little crazy, and I should know better than to try to change your mind."
"I will pray to God to preserve you. You'll have a chance here. You're young and beautiful, and maybe they won't know you're Jewish. But me, a useless old man muttering Hebrew prayers, me, they would send to a camp where I would surely die. It is always better to live. You said that."
She tried to persuade him to stay with her for one night at least, but he would not. She gave him a sweater and a scarf and all the cash she had in the house, and told him that if he waited a day she could get more money from the bank and buy him a good coat. But he was in a hurry. She cried and dried her eyes, and cried again. When he left, she looked out of her window and saw him walking along the street, an old man going up out of Egypt and into the wilderness, following in the footsteps of the children of Israel. There was something of the old man left. His orthodoxy had mellowed, but he still had a will of iron. He disappeared into the crowd, and she left the window. When she thought of his courage, she knew she could not run out on Van Dam.
"She's an intriguing girl," Wolf said. "I can't quite figure her out."
He was sitting on the bed, watching Sonia get dressed.
"She's a little jumpy. When I told her we were going on a picnic, she acted quite scared and said she hardly knew me, as if she needed a chaperone."
"With you, she did," Sonia said.
"And yet she can be very earthy and direct."
"Just bring her home to me.
I'll figure her out.
It bothers me.
Wolf frowned. He was thinking aloud.
Somebody tried to jump into the taxi with us.
A beggar?
No. He was a European.
A European beggar?
Sonia stopped brushing her hair to look at Wolf in the mirror.
This town is full of crazy people, you know that. Listen, if you have second thoughts, just picture her writhing on that bed with you and me on either side of her.
Wolf grinned. It was an appealing picture, but not an irresistible one. It was Sonia's fantasy, not his. His instinct told him to lay low now and not make dates with anyone. But Sonia was going to insist, and he still needed her.
Sonia said, "And when am I going to contact Kamel? He must know by now that you're living here."
Wolf sighed. Another date. Another claim on him. Another danger. Also, another person whose protection he needed.
Call him tonight from the club. I'm not in a rush for this meeting, but we've got to keep him sweet.
Okay.
She was ready, and her taxi was waiting.
Make a date with Elena.
She went out. She was not in his power the way she had once been, Wolf realized. The walls you build to protect you also close in. Could he afford to defy her? If there had been a clear and immediate danger, yes. But all he had was a vague nervousness, an intuitive inclination to keep his head down. And Sonia might be crazy enough to betray him if she really got angry. He was obliged to choose the lesser danger. He got up from the bed, found a paper and a pen, and sat down to write a note to Elena.
Chapter 17. The message came the day after Elena's father left for Jerusalem. A small boy came to the door with an envelope. Elena tipped him and read the letter. It was short. "My dear Elena, let us meet at the Oasis restaurant at 8 o'clock next Thursday. I eagerly look forward to it. Fondly, Alex Wolf." Unlike his speech, his writing had a stiffness which seemed German. But perhaps it was her imagination. Thursday. That was the day after tomorrow. She did not know whether to be elated or scared. Her first thought was to telephone Van Damme. Then she hesitated. She had become intensely curious about Van Damme. She knew so little about him. What did he do when he was not catching spies? Did he listen to music? Collect stamps? Shoot duck? Was he interested in poetry or architecture or antique rugs? What was his home like? With whom did he live? What color were his pajamas? She wanted to patch up their quarrel, and she wanted to see where he lived. She had an excuse to contact him now, but instead of telephoning, she would go to his home. She decided to change her dress. Then she decided to take a bath first. Then she decided to wash her hair as well. Sitting in the bath, she thought about which dress to wear. She recalled the occasions she had seen Van Damme and tried to remember which clothes she had worn. He had never seen the pale pink one with puffed shoulders and buttons all down the front. That was very pretty. She put on a little perfume, then the silk underwear Johnny had given her, which always made her feel so feminine. Her short hair was dry already, and she sat in front of the mirror to comb it. The dark, fine locks gleamed after washing. "I look ravishing," she thought, and she smiled at herself seductively. She left the apartment, taking Wolf's note with her. Van Damme would be interested to see his handwriting. He was interested in every little detail where Wolf was concerned, perhaps because they had never met face to face, except in the dark or at a distance. The handwriting was very neat, easily legible, almost like an artist's lettering. Van Damme would draw some conclusion from that. She headed for Garden City. It was 7 o'clock, and Van Damme worked until late, so she had time to spare. The sun was still strong, and she enjoyed the heat on her arms and legs as she walked. A bunch of soldiers whistled at her, and in her sunny mood she smiled at them, so they followed her for a few blocks before they got diverted into a bar. She felt gay and reckless. What a good idea it was to go to his house. So much better than sitting alone at home. She had been alone too much. For her men, she had existed only when they had time to visit her.
and she had made their attitudes her own, so that when they were not there, she felt she had nothing to do, no role to play, no one to be. Now she had broken with all that. By doing this, by going to see him uninvited, she felt she was being herself instead of a person in someone else's dream. It made her almost giddy. She found the house easily. It was a small French colonial villa, all pillars and high windows, its white stone reflecting the evening sun with painful brilliance. She walked up the short drive, rang the bell, and waited in the shadow of the portico. An elderly, bald Egyptian came to the door.
"Good evening, madam,"
he said, speaking like an English butler. Elena said, "I'd like to see Major Van Damme. My name is Elena Fontana."
"The Major has not yet returned home, madam."
The servant hesitated.
"Perhaps I could wait," Elena said. "Of course, madam."
He stepped aside to admit her. She crossed the threshold. She looked around with nervous eagerness. She was in a cool, tiled hall with a high ceiling. Before she could take it all in, the servant said,
"This way, madam."
He led her into a drawing room.
"My name is Gaffar. Please call me if there is anything you require."
"Thank you, Gaffar." The servant went out. Elena was thrilled to be in Van Damme's house and left alone to look around. The drawing room had a large marble fireplace and a lot of very English furniture. Somehow she thought he had not furnished it himself. Everything was clean and tidy and not very lived in. What did this say about his character? Perhaps nothing. The door opened and a young boy walked in. He was very good-looking, with curly brown hair and smooth, pre-adolescent skin. He seemed about 10 years old. He looked vaguely familiar. He said,
"Hello, I'm Billy Van Damme."
Elena stared at him in horror. A son. Van Damme had a son. She knew now why he seemed familiar. He resembled his father. Why had it never occurred to her that Van Damme might be married? A man like that, charming, kind, handsome, clever, was unlikely to have reached his late 30s without getting hooked. What a fool she had been to think that she might have been the first to desire him. She felt so stupid that she blushed. She shook Billy's hand.
"How do you do?" she said. "I'm Elena Fontana."
"We never know what time Dad's coming home," Billy said. "I hope you won't have to wait too long." She had not yet recovered her composure.
"Don't worry, I don't mind. It doesn't matter a bit."
"Would you like a drink or anything?" He was very polite, like his father, with a formality that was somehow disarming. Elena said,
"No, thank you."
"Well, I've got to have my supper. Sorry to leave you alone."
"No, no. If you need anything, just call Gaffar."
"Thank you." The boy went out and Elena sat down heavily. She was disoriented, as if in her own home she had found a door to a room she had not known was there. She noticed a photograph on the marble mantelpiece and got up to look at it. It was a picture of a beautiful woman in her early 20s, a cool, aristocratic-looking woman with a faintly supercilious smile. Elena admired the dress she was wearing, something silky and flowing, hanging in elegant folds from her slender figure. The woman's hair and makeup were perfect. The eyes were startlingly familiar, clear and perceptive, and light in color. Elena realized that Billy had eyes like that. This, then, was Billy's mother, Van Damme's wife. She was, of course, exactly the kind of woman who would be his wife, a classic English beauty with a superior air.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Elena felt she had been a fool. Women like that were queuing up to marry men like Van Damme. as if he would have bypassed all of them only to fall for an Egyptian courtesan. She rehearsed the things that divided her from him. He was respectable, and she was disreputable. He was British, and she was Egyptian. He was Christian, presumably, and she was Jewish. He was well-bred, and she came out of the slums of Alexandria. He was almost 40, and she was 23. The list was long. Tucked into the back of the photograph frame was a page torn from a magazine. The paper was old and yellowing. The page bore the same photograph. Elena saw that it had come from a magazine called The Tattler. She had heard of it. It was much read by the wives of colonels in Cairo, for it reported all the trivial events of London society. Parties, balls, charity lunches, gallery openings, and the activities of English royalty. The picture of Mrs. Van Damme took up most of this page, and a paragraph of type beneath the picture reported that Angela, daughter of Sir Peter and Lady Beresford, was engaged to be married to Lieutenant William Van Damme, son of Mr. and Mrs. John Van Damme of Gately, Dorset. Elena refolded the cutting and put it back. The family picture was complete. Attractive British officer, cool, self-assured English wife, intelligent, charming son, beautiful home, money, class, and happiness. Everything else was a dream. She wandered around the room, wondering if it held any more shocks in store. The room had been furnished by Mrs. Van Damme, of course, in perfect, bloodless taste. The decorous print of the curtains toned with the restrained hue of the upholstery and the elegant striped wallpaper. Elena wondered what their bedroom would be like. It, too, would be coolly tasteful, she guessed. Perhaps the main color would be blue-green, the shade they called Eau de Nil, although it was not a bit like the muddy water of the Nile. Would they have twin beds? She hoped so. She would never know. Against one wall was a small upright piano. She wondered who played. Perhaps Mrs. Van Damme sat here sometimes, in the evenings, filling the air with Chopin, while Van Damme sat in the armchair, over there, watching her fondly. Perhaps Van Damme accompanied himself as he sang romantic ballads to her in a strong tenor. Perhaps Billy had a tutor, and fingered hesitant scales every afternoon when he came home from school. She looked through the pile of sheet music in the seat of the piano stool. She had been right about the Chopin. They had all the waltzes here in a book. She picked up a novel from the top of the piano and opened it. She read the first line. Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. The opening sentences intrigued her, and she wondered whether Van Damme was reading the book. Perhaps she could borrow it. It would be good to have something of his. On the other hand, she had the feeling he was not a great reader of fiction. She did not want to borrow it from his wife. Billy came in. Elena put the book down suddenly, feeling irrationally guilty, as if she had been prying. Billy saw the gesture. "That one's no good," he said. "It's about some silly girl who's afraid of her husband's housekeeper. There's no action." Elena sat down, and Billy sat opposite her. Obviously, he was going to entertain her. He was a miniature of his father, except for those clear gray eyes. She said, "You've read it, then?" "Rebecca? Yes. But I didn't like it much. I always finish them, though." "What do you like to read?" "I like Tex best."
"Tex?"
"Detectives. I've read all of Agatha Christie's and Dorothy Sayers. But I like the American ones most of all. S.S. Van Dyne and Raymond Chandler."
"Really?"
Elena smiled. "I like detective stories, too. I read them all the time."
"Oh? Who's your favorite, Tex?"
Elena considered.
"Maigret."
"I've never heard of him. What's the author's name?"
"Georges Simenon. He writes in French, but now some of the books have been translated into English. They're set in Paris, mostly. They're very complex."
"Would you lend me one? It's so hard to get new books. I've read all the ones in this house and in the school library. And I swap with my friends, but they like, you know, stories about children having adventures in the school holidays."
"All right," Elena said. "Let's swap. What have you got to lend me? I don't think I've read any American ones."
I'll lend you a Chandler. The American ones are much more true to life, you know. I've gone off those stories about English country houses and people who probably couldn't murder a fly. It was odd, Alina thought, that a boy for whom the English country house might be part of everyday life should find stories about American private eyes more true to life. She hesitated, then asked, "Does your mother read detective stories?" Billy said briskly, "My mother died last year in Crete."
"Oh."
Alina put her hand to her mouth. She felt the blood drain from her face. So Van Damme was not married. A moment later, she felt ashamed that that had been her first thought, and sympathy for the child her second. She said, "Billy, how awful for you. I'm so sorry." Real death had suddenly intruded into their light-hearted talk of murder stories, and she felt embarrassed. "It's all right," Billy said. "It's the war, you see." And now he was like his father again. For a while, talking about books, he had been full of boyish enthusiasm. But now the mask was on, and it was a smaller version of the mask used by his father. Courtesy, formality, the attitude of the considerate host. "It's the war, you see." He had heard someone else say that, and had adopted it as his own defense. She wondered whether his preference for true-to-life murders, as opposed to implausible country house killings, dated from the death of his mother. Now he was looking around him, searching for something, inspiration perhaps. In a moment he would offer her cigarettes, whiskey, tea. It was hard enough to know what to say to a bereaved adult. With Billy, she felt helpless. She decided to talk of something else. She said awkwardly, "I suppose, with your father working at GHQ, you get more news of the war than the rest of us." "I suppose I do, but usually I don't really understand it. When he comes home in a bad mood, I know we've lost another battle." He started to bite a fingernail, then stuffed his hands into his shorts pockets. "I wish I was older." "You want to fight?" He looked at her fiercely, as if he thought she was mocking him. "I'm not one of those kids who thinks it's all jolly good fun like the cowboy films." She murmured, "I'm sure you're not." "It's just that I'm afraid the Germans will win." Alina thought, "Oh, Billy, if you were 10 years older, I'd fall in love with you too." "It might not be so bad," she said. "They're not monsters." He gave her a skeptical look. She should have known better than to soft soap him. He said, "They'd only do to us what we've been doing to the Egyptians for 50 years. It was another of his father's lines, she was sure. Billy said, "But then it would all have been for nothing." He bit his nail again, and this time he did not stop himself. Alina wondered what would have been for nothing. The death of his mother? His own personal struggle to be brave? The 2-year seesaw of the Desert War? European civilization? "Well, it hasn't happened yet," she said feebly. Billy looked at the clock on the mantelpiece. "I'm supposed to go to bed at 9. Suddenly he was a child again. "I suppose you'd better go then." "Yes." He stood up. "May I come and say good night to you in a few minutes?" "If you like." He went out. What kind of life did they lead in this house? Alina wondered. The man, the boy, and the old servant lived here together, each with his own concerns. Was there laughter and kindness and affection? Did they have time to play games and sing songs and go on picnics? By comparison with her own childhood, Billy's was enormously privileged. Nevertheless, she feared this might be a terribly adult household for a boy to grow up in. His young old wisdom was charming, but he seemed like a child who did not have much fun. She experienced a rush of compassion for him, a motherless child in an alien country, besieged by foreign armies. She left the drawing room and went upstairs. There seemed to be 3 or 4 bedrooms on the second floor, with a narrow staircase leading up to a third floor where, presumably, Ghaffar slept. One of the bedroom doors was open, and she went in. It did not look much like a small boy's bedroom. Alina did not know a lot about small boys. She had 4 sisters. But she was expecting to see model airplanes, jigsaw puzzles, a train set, sports gear, and perhaps an old, neglected teddy bear. She would not have been surprised to see clothes on the floor, a construction set on the bed, and a pair of dirty football boots on the polished surface of a desk. But the place might almost have been the bedroom of an adult. The clothes were folded neatly on a chair. The top of the chest of drawers was clear. Schoolbooks were stacked tidily on the desk. And the only toy in evidence was a cardboard model of a tank. Billy was in bed, his striped pajama top buttoned to the neck, a book on the blanket beside him. "I like your room," Elena said deceitfully. Billy said, "It's fine." "What are you reading?" "The Greek Coffin Mystery." She sat on the edge of the bed. "Well, don't stay awake too late." "I've to put out the light at 9:30. She leaned forward suddenly and kissed his cheek. At that moment the door opened and Van Damme walked in. It was the familiarity of the scene that was so shocking. The boy in bed with his book, the light from the bedside lamp falling just so, the woman leaning forward to kiss the boy good night. Van Damme stood and stared, feeling like one who knows he is in a dream but still cannot wake up. Elena stood up and said, "Hello, William."
"Hello, Elena."
"Good night, Billy."
"Good night, Miss Fontana."
She went past Van Damme and left the room. Van Damme sat on the edge of the bed, in the dip in the covers which she had vacated. He said, "Been entertaining our guest?"
"Yes."
"Good man."
"I like her. She reads detective stories. We're going to swap books."
"That's grand. Have you done your prep?"
"Yes. French vocab."
"Want me to test you?"
"It's all right. Gafar tested me." "I say, she's ever so pretty, isn't she?"
"Yes. She's working on something for me. It's a bit hush-hush, so..."
"My lips are sealed."
Van Damme smiled. "That's the stuff."
Billy lowered his voice. "Is she, you know, a secret agent?"
Van Damme put a finger to his lips. "Walls have ears." The boy looked suspicious.
"You're having me on."
Van Damme shook his head silently. Billy said,
"Gosh."
Van Damme stood up. "Lights out at 9:30.
"Righto. Good night."
"Good night, Billy." Van Damme went out. As he closed the door, it occurred to him that Elena's goodnight kiss had probably done Billy a lot more good than his father's man-to-man chat. He found Elena in the drawing room, shaking martinis. He felt he should have resented more than he did the way she had made herself at home in his house, but he was too tired to strike attitudes. He sank gratefully into a chair and accepted a drink. Elena said, "Busy day?" Van Damme's whole section had been working on the new wireless security procedures that were being introduced following the capture of the German listening unit at the Hill of Jesus. But Van Damme was not going to tell Elena that. Also, he felt she was play-acting the role of housewife, and she had no right to do that. He said, "What made you come here?"
"I've got a date with Wolf."
"Wonderful." Van Damme immediately forgot all lesser concerns. "When?"
"Thursday."
She handed him a sheet of paper. He studied the message. It was a peremptory summons written in a clear, stylish script. "How did this come?"
"A boy brought it to my door."
"Did you question the boy?" "Where was he given the message, and by whom, and so on?" She was crestfallen.
"I never thought to do that."
"Never mind. Wolf would have taken precautions anyway. The boy would have known nothing of value."
"What will we do?" Elena asked.
"The same as last time, only better." Van Damme tried to sound more confident than he felt. "It should have been simple. The man makes a date with a girl, so you go to the meeting place and arrest the man when he turns up. But Wolf was unpredictable. He would not get away with the taxi trick again. Van Damme would have the restaurant surrounded, 20 or 30 men and several cars, roadblocks in readiness, and so on. But he might try a different trick." Van Damme could not imagine what, and that was the problem. As if she were reading his mind, Elena said,
"I don't want to spend another evening with him."
"Why?"
"He frightens me."
Van Damme felt guilty. Remember Istanbul, and suppressed his sympathy. "But last time he did you no harm."
He didn't try to seduce me, so I didn't have to say no. But he will. And I'm afraid he won't take no for an answer.
We've learned our lesson, Van Damme said with false assurance. There'll be no mistakes this time. Secretly, he was surprised by her simple determination not to go to bed with Wolf. He had assumed that such things did not matter much, one way or the other, to her. He had misjudged her then. Seeing her in this new light somehow made him very cheerful. He decided he must be honest with her.
I should rephrase that, he said. I'll do everything in my power to make sure that there are no mistakes this time.
Gaffar came in and said,
Dinner is served, sir.
Van Damme smiled. Gaffar was doing his English butler act in honor of the feminine company. Van Damme said to Elena, Have you eaten?
No.
What have we got, Gaffar?
For you, sir, clear soup, scrambled eggs, and yogurt. But I took the liberty of grilling a chop for Miss Fontana.
Elena said to Van Damme, Do you always eat like that?
No, it's because of my cheek. I can't chew.
He stood up. As they went into the dining room, Elena said, Does it still hurt?
Only when I laugh. It's true, I can't stretch the muscles on that side. I've got into the habit of smiling with one side of my face.
They sat down, and Gaffar served the soup. Elena said, I like your son very much.
So do I, Van Damme said.
He's old beyond his years.
Do you think that's a bad thing?
She shrugged. Who knows? He's been through a couple of things that ought to be reserved for adults.
Yes.
Elena hesitated. When did your wife die?
May the 28th, 1941, in the evening.
Billy told me it happened in Crete.
Yes. She worked on cryptanalysis for the Air Force. She was on a temporary posting to Crete at the time the Germans invaded the island. May 28th was the day the British realized they had lost the battle and decided to get out. Apparently, she was hit by a stray shell and killed instantly. Of course, we were trying to get live people away then, not bodies, so... There's no grave, you see. No memorial. Nothing left.
Elena said quietly, Do you still love her?
I think I'll always be in love with her. I believe it's like that with people you really love. If they go away or die, it makes no difference. If ever I were to marry again, I would still love Angela.
Were you very happy?
He hesitated, unwilling to answer. Then he realized that the hesitation was an answer in itself. Ours wasn't an idyllic marriage. It was I who was devoted. Angela was fond of me.
Do you think you will marry again?
Well, the English in Cairo keep thrusting replicas of Angela at me.
He shrugged. He did not know the answer to the question. Elena seemed to understand, for she fell silent and began to eat her dessert. Afterward, Gaffar brought them coffee in the drawing room. It was at this time of day that Van Damme usually began to hit the bottle seriously. But tonight he did not want to drink. He sent Gaffar to bed, and they drank their coffee. Van Damme smoked a cigarette. He felt a desire for music. He had loved music at one time, although lately it had gone out of his life. Now, with the mild night air coming in through the open windows and the smoke curling up from his cigarette, he wanted to hear clear, delightful notes and sweet harmonies and subtle rhythms. He went to the piano and looked at the music. Elena watched him in silence. He began to play Für Elise. The first few notes sounded, with Beethoven's characteristic devastating simplicity. Then the hesitation. Then the rolling tune. The ability to play came back to him instantly, almost as if he had never stopped. His hands knew what to do in a way he always felt was miraculous. When the song was over, he went back to Elena, sat next to her, and kissed her cheek. Her face was wet with tears. She said, William, I love you with all my heart. They whisper. She says, I like your ears. He says, Nobody has ever licked them before. She giggles. Do you like it?
Yes, yes.
He sighs. Can I...
Undo the buttons. Here.
That's right.
Ah. I'll put out the light.
No, I want to see you.
There's a moon.
Click.
There, see? The moonlight's enough.
Come back here, quickly.
I'm here.
Kiss me again, William.
They do not speak for a while. Then, can I take this thing off? He says.
Let me help. There.
Oh. Oh, they're so pretty.
I'm so glad you like them. Would you do that harder?
Suck a little.
Oh, God.
And a little later, she says,
let me feel your chest.
Damn buttons, I've ripped your shirt. The hell with that.
I knew it would be like this. Look.
What?
Our skin's in the moonlight. You're so pale and I'm nearly black. Look.
Yes.
Touch me. Stroke me. Squeeze and pinch and explore. I want to feel your hands all over me.
Yes.
Everywhere, your hands. There. Yes. Especially there. Oh, you know. You know exactly where. Oh.
You're so soft inside.
This is a dream.
No, it's real.
I never want to wake up.
So soft.
And you're so hard. Can I kiss it?
Yes, please. Oh, Jesus, it feels good. Jesus.
William?
Yes.
Now, William?
Oh, yes.
Take them off.
Silk.
Yes, be quick.
Yes.
I've wanted this for so long.
She gasps, and he makes a sound like a sob. And then there is only their breathing for many minutes, until finally he begins to shout aloud, and she smothers his cries with her kisses, and then she too feels it, and she turns her face into the cushion, and opens her mouth, and screams into the cushion. And he, not being used to this, thinks something is wrong, and says, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right. And finally, she goes limp, and lies with her eyes closed for a while, perspiring, until her breathing returns to normal. Then she looks up at him and says, so that's how it's supposed to be. And he laughs, and she looks quizzically at him. So he explains, that's exactly what I was thinking. Then they both laugh, and he says, I've done a lot of things after, you know, afterwards, but I don't think I've ever laughed.
I'm so glad, she says. Oh, William, I'm so glad.
Chapter 18. Rommel could smell the sea. At Tobruk, the heat and the dust and the flies were as bad as they had been in the desert. But it was all made bearable by that occasional whiff of salty dampness in the faint breeze. Von Malenthin came into the command vehicle with his intelligence report.
Good evening, Field Marshal.
Rommel smiled. He had been promoted after the victory at Tobruk, and he had not yet gotten used to the new title.
Anything new?
A signal from the spy in Cairo. He says the Mersa-Metru line is weak in the middle.
Rommel took the report and began to glance over it. He smiled when he read that the Allies anticipated he would try a dash around the southern end of the line. It seemed they were beginning to understand his thinking. He said,
so the minefield gets thinner at this point. But there the line is defended by two columns. What is a column?
It's a new term they're using. According to one of our prisoners of war, a column is a brigade group that has been twice overrun by panzers.
A weak force, then?
Yes.
Rommel tapped the report with his forefinger.
If this is correct, we can burst through the Mersa-Matru line as soon as we get there.
I'll be doing my best to check the spy's report over the next day or two, of course, said von Malenthin. But he was right last time.
The door to the vehicle flew open and Kesselring came in. Rommel was startled.
Field Marshal, he said, I thought you were in Sicily.
I was, Kesselring said. He stamped the dust off his handmade boots.
I've just flown here to see you. Damn it, Rommel, this has got to stop. Your orders are quite clear. You were to advance to Tobruk and no farther.
Rommel sat back in his canvas chair. He had hoped to keep Kesselring out of this argument.
The circumstances have changed, he said. But your original orders have been confirmed by the Italian Supreme Command,
said Kesselring. And what was your reaction? You declined the advice and invited Bustico to lunch with you in Cairo. Nothing infuriated Rommel more than orders from Italians. The Italians have done nothing in this war, he said angrily. That is irrelevant. Your air and sea support is now needed for the attack on Malta. After we have taken Malta, your communications will be secure for the advance to Egypt. You people have learned nothing, Rommel said. He made an effort to lower his voice. While we are digging in, the enemy too will be digging in. I did not get this far by playing the old game of advance, consolidate, then advance again. When they attack, I dodge. When they defend a position, I go around that position. And when they retreat, I chase them. They are running now, and now is the time to take Egypt. Kesselring remained calm. I have a copy of your cable to Mussolini. He took a piece of paper from his pocket and read, The state and morale of the troops, the present supply position owing to captured dumps and the present weakness of the enemy, permit our pursuing him into the depths of the Egyptian area. He folded the sheet of paper and turned to von Melenthin. How many German tanks and men do we have? Rommel suppressed the urge to tell von Melenthin not to answer. He knew this was a weak point. 60 tanks, Field Marshal, and 2,500 men. And the Italians? 6,000 men and 14 tanks. Kesselring turned back to Rommel. And you're going to take Egypt with a total of 74 tanks? Von Melenthin, what is our estimate of the enemy's strength? The Allied forces are approximately 3 times as numerous as ours, but... There you are. Von Melenthin went on. But we are very well supplied with food, clothing, trucks, and armored cars, and fuel. And the men are in tremendous spirits. Rommel said, Von Melenthin, go to the communications truck and see what has arrived. Von Melenthin frowned, but Rommel did not explain, so he went out. Rommel said, The Allies are regrouping at Mersa Matruh. They expect us to move around the southern end of their line. Instead, we will hit the middle, where they are weakest. How do you know all this? Kesselring interrupted. Our intelligence assessment... On what is the assessment based? Primarily on a spy report. My God! For the first time, Kesselring raised his voice. You've no tanks, but you have your spy. He was right last time. Von Melenthin came back in. Kesselring said, All this makes no difference. I am here to confirm the Führer's orders. You are to advance no farther. Rommel smiled. I have sent a personal envoy to the Führer. You? I am a field marshal now. I have direct access to Hitler. Of course. I think von Melenthin may have the Führer's reply. Yes, said von Melenthin. He read from a sheet of paper. It is only once in a lifetime that the goddess of victory smiles. Onward to Cairo. Adolf Hitler. There was a silence. Kesselring walked out. Chapter 19. When Van Damme got to his office, he learned that the previous evening, Rommel had advanced to within 60 miles of Alexandria. Rommel seemed unstoppable. The Mersa Matruh line had broken in half like a matchstick. In the south, the 13th Corps had retreated in a panic, and in the north, the fortress of Mersa Matruh had capitulated. The Allies had fallen back once again. But this would be the last time. The new line of defense stretched across a 30-mile gap between the sea and the impassable Katara Depression, and if that line fell, there would be no more defenses. Egypt would be Rommel's. The news was not enough to dampen Van Damme's elation. It was more than 24 hours since he had awakened at dawn on the sofa in his drawing room with Elena in his arms. Since then he had been suffused with a kind of adolescent glee. He kept remembering little details. How small and brown her nipples were. The taste of her skin. Her sharp fingernails digging into his thighs. In the office he had been behaving a little out of character, he knew. He had given back a letter to his typist saying, There are 7 errors in this, you'd better do it again, and smiled at her sunnily.
She had nearly fallen off her chair. He thought of Elena, and he thought, why not? Why the hell not? And there was no reply. He was visited early by an officer from the Special Liaison Unit. Anybody with his ear to the ground in GHQ now knew the SLUs had a very special, ultra-secret source of intelligence. Opinions differed as to how good the intelligence was, and evaluation was always difficult because they would never tell you the source. Brown, who held the rank of captain but was quite plainly not a military man, leaned on the edge of the table and spoke around the stem of his pipe.
Are you being evacuated, Van Damme?
These chaps lived in a world of their own, and there was no point in telling them that a certain captain had to call a major sir. Van Damme said,
What? Evacuated? Why? Our lot's off to Jerusalem. So's everyone who knows too much. Keep people out of enemy hands, you know.
The brass is getting nervous, then. It was logical, really. Rommel could cover 60 miles in a day.
There'll be riots at the station, you'll see. Half Cairo's trying to get out, and the other half is preening itself, ready for the liberation. Ha!
You won't tell too many people that you're going.
No, no, no.
Now then, I've got a little snippet for you. We all know Rommel's got a spy in Cairo.
How did you know? Van Damme said.
Stuff comes through from London, old boy. Anyhow, the chap has been identified as, and I quote, the hero of the Rashid Ali affair. Mean anything to you?
Van Damme was thunderstruck.
It does, he said.
Well, that's it.
Brown got off the table.
Just a minute, Van Damme said.
Is that all?
I'm afraid so.
What is this, a decrypt or an agent report?
Suffice it to say that the source is reliable.
You always say that.
Yes. Well, I may not see you for a while. Good luck.
Thanks, Van Damme muttered distractedly.
Too low.
Brown went out, puffing smoke. The hero of the Rashid Ali affair. It was incredible that Wolfe should have been the man who outwitted Van Damme in Istanbul. Yet it made sense. Van Damme recalled the odd feeling he had had about Wolfe's style, as if it were familiar. The girl whom Van Damme had sent to pick up the mystery man had had her throat cut. And now Van Damme was sending Elena in against the same man. A corporal came in with an order. Van Damme read it with mounting disbelief. All departments were to extract from their files those papers which might be dangerous in enemy hands and burn them. Just about anything in the files of an intelligence section might be dangerous in enemy hands. We might as well burn the whole damn lot, Van Damme thought. And how would departments operate afterward? Clearly, the brass thought the departments would not be operating at all for very much longer. Of course, it was a precaution, but it was a very drastic one. They would not destroy the accumulated results of years of work unless they thought there was a very strong chance indeed of the Germans taking Egypt. It's going to pieces, he thought. It's falling apart. It was unthinkable. Van Damme had given 3 years of his life to the defense of Egypt. Thousands of men had died in the desert. After all that, was it possible that we could lose? Actually give up? And turn? And run away? It did not bear contemplating. He called Jakes in and watched him read the order. Jakes just nodded, as if he had been expecting it. Van Damme said,
Bit drastic, isn't it?
It's rather like what's been happening in the desert, sir, Jakes replied. We establish huge supply dumps at enormous cost. Then, as we retreat, we blow them up to keep them out of enemy hands.
Van Damme nodded. All right, you'd better get on with it. Try and play it down a bit for the sake of morale. You know, brass getting the wind up unnecessarily, that sort of thing.
Yes, sir. We'll have the bonfire in the yard at the back, shall we?
Yes. Find an old dustbin and poke holes in its bottom. Make sure the stuff burns up properly.
What about your own files?
I'll go through them now.
Very good, sir.
Jakes went out.
Van Damme opened his file drawer and began to sort through his papers. Countless times over the last 3 years he had thought, I don't need to remember that, I can always look it up. There were names and addresses, security reports on individuals, details of codes, systems of communication of orders, case notes, and a little file of jottings about Alex Wolfe. Jakes brought in a big cardboard box with Lipton's tea printed on its side, and Van Damme began to dump papers into it, thinking, this is what it is like to be the losers. The box was half full when Van Damme's corporal opened the door and said, Major Smith to see you, sir. Send him in. Van Damme did not know a Major Smith. The Major was a small, thin man in his 40s, with bulbous blue eyes and an air of being rather pleased with himself. He shook hands and said, Sandy Smith, S.I.S. Van Damme said, What can I do for the Secret Intelligence Service? I'm sort of the liaison man between S.I.S. and the General Staff, Smith explained. You made an inquiry about a book called Rebecca.
Yes.
The answer got routed through us.
Smith produced a piece of paper with a flourish.
Van Damme read the message. The S.I.S. head of station in Portugal had followed up the query about Rebecca by sending one of his men to visit all the English-language bookstores in the country. In the holiday area of Estoril, he had found a bookseller who recalled selling his entire stock, 6 copies, of Rebecca to one woman. On further investigation, the woman had turned out to be the wife of the German military attaché in Lisbon. Van Damme said, This confirms something I suspected. Thank you for taking the trouble to bring it over.
No trouble, Smith said. I'm over here every morning anyway, glad to be able to help.
He went out.
Van Damme reflected on the news while he went on with his work. There was only one plausible explanation of the fact that the book had found its way from Estoril to the Sahara. Undoubtedly, it was the basis of a code. And unless there were 2 successful German spies in Cairo, it was Alex Wolfe who was using that code. The information would be useful sooner or later. It was a pity the key to the code had not been captured along with the book and the decrypt. That thought reminded him of the importance of burning his secret papers, and he determined to be